in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from JBJ Gifts, Home Decor, and Collectibles, 723 South Neal, two blocks south of Green Street in Champaign. JBJ's offers Christmas decorations including Christmas ornaments, angels, Santas, snowmen and nativities, gifts, collectibles, and home decor items. More information is available online at jbjgifts.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first part of the show today, we'll be talking about tort reform. This is an issue that has been on the table in Washington now for some time. When President Bush was campaigning first time around and was elected first time, he said that one of his priorities would be legal reform. And now that he has been reelected, he says that again, in the second Bush administration, tort reform would be a priority. And here is the way that the Republican Party platform addressed the issue. Quote, America's litigation system is broken. Junk and frivolous lawsuits are driving up the cost of doing business in America by forcing companies to pay excessive legal expenses to fight off or settle often baseless lawsuits, unquote. This is an issue that seems to break down along partisan lines, and that is that Republicans tend to favor tort reform and Democrats tend to oppose it. This morning we'll have a show with a representative of an organization that indeed favors tort reform, and you can tell that by the name of the group. Our guest this morning is Sherman Joyce, and he is president of the American Tort Reform Association. It is a coalition that includes nonprofits, professional societies, trade associations, and corporations that are interested in this issue. And I do want to mention right up front that obviously there are different points of view on tort reform. There are people who don't believe that there is any problem with the system, and we will have some shows in the future with other guests with different points of view, but this is sort of our first pass on the topic. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. He's a graduate of Princeton. After graduating there, he served as legislative assistant to U.S. Senator John Danforth. After graduating from law school, he then served as minority counsel to the Subcommittee on Science, Technology, and Space of the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation. He then moved within the Commerce Committee staff to become minority counsel to the Subcommittee on the Consumer. In that capacity, he was the lead Republican staff member on legislation to establish uniform rules for product liability law. In addition, he advised senators on issues pertaining to product safety, antitrust law, advertising, and consumer and telemarketing fraud. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, of course, questions are welcome from people who are listening. All we ask of people who call in is that they are brief, and we just ask that so we can keep the program moving. We can get in as many different people as possible, but of course, questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So locally here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Joyce, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
I'm happy to be here with you.
Just to make sure that people know what it is we are talking about, because I think if we went out on the street and started, you know, stopped people and said, what is a tort, we might get a variety of answers, but unless they were an attorney, they might not speak to it in the legal sense. And I guess as I understand it, and as I think people will understand it if you use the phrase, we're talking here about personal injury matters, people who might sue a physician for medical malpractice. They might sue a tobacco company because they felt that they got sick from cigarettes. They might sue a company that manufactured a product that they felt was harmful. It also can be a matter of lawsuits between individuals, but the things that probably get the most attention are the lawsuits involving large companies that sometimes result in very large decisions in favor of the plaintiffs.
Well, I think those are good examples of some of the kinds of issues that we deal with. The term tort is a term that really, it's not the pastry with the E at the end. It's a legal term that people do learn and students learn in law school, having to do with injuries. They need not necessarily technically be personal injuries. Defamation is a tort. It is really, the way to think of it is really kind of a injury or damage to an individual that is not in a more or less a contractual type relationship. Mm-hmm. But from our perspective, and clearly the items that you the aspects that you mentioned are at the core of what we're focusing on. But there are other aspects of more general legal reform and civil litigation reform that we would focus on. Some of them are more have to do with the process or the procedures of litigation, and others have to do with matters such as what type of technical or scientific evidence is appropriate in these types of cases. So it's a fairly, from our perspective, we see it as a fairly expansive topic, although obviously to a layman, it may seem like kind of a narrow area.
Sure. Well, it seems that the aspect of this that gets the most attention in the press, or at least according to what I've read, does indeed have to do with damage awards, essentially. The concern seems to be, particularly among people who, you know, organizations like yours that might include large corporations, for example, the concern is very high damage awards. And so what people are talking about is putting some caps on how much can be awarded, doing something about how it is that attorneys are compensated, because in many of these cases, what the attorney is fees come out of some percentage of the damages that are awarded to the plaintiff. Let me ask you this question. In what sense do you think, if you think the system is broken, in what sense do you think that it's broken? What's wrong with the way that these cases are now carried out?
Well, the part of our name is the American Tort Reform Association. We think that the system has, that there are aspects that have developed over a long period of time that need to be addressed. Sometimes there may be an issue that has arisen rather quickly through the courts, or it might be as a result of something that a legislature has done. Here's a good example. We believe that in the era of comparative fault, and I use that as a legal term in the sense, but I think it's easy to understand, in civil litigation, in most states, not in every state, but in most states, if there are multiple defendants, then the liability of those different defendants is apportioned among them. And some defendants may be only minimally at fault. Others may be more substantially at fault. And we believe that there should be proper apportionment of fault based on an individual's what the court has determined or a jury has determined is their fault. In other words, if you've got three or four defendants in a case and one defendant, say, is only 10 or 15% responsible, that's the determination made by the jury, then we don't think that individual or entity should be responsible for 100% of a particular award. We think that has to do more with fairness than the actual amount of the underlying case. I do want to make a point about a comment that you made.
Yes.
It is clear that the public's attention is grabbed, and really, you know, at least from what we can tell, when there is a very large award. 10 years ago, an award of less than $3 million got a lot of national attention and got onto the late-night talk shows, and that was the McDonald's coffee case. And some people thought it was funny. Some people thought it was actually a case involving a woman who suffered serious injuries. Where we found fault with that case was not with anything other than the fact that the New Mexico courts really didn't have what we thought were appropriate standards for assessing what the liability should be. The jury was told that McDonald's made, well, I think it was $1.35 million a day selling coffee. So the jury assessed punitive damages to punish McDonald's of $2.7 million. They were allowed to, in effect, make the punishment up. We don't take a position on whether there should or shouldn't have been liability with McDonald's. But we would not tolerate as a society imposing criminal penalties on an individual that a group of 12 people were simply allowed to determine on the spot. We're a society of laws. Now, I mention that also because back in 1994, that the amount of that verdict was considered headline-making. You know, it was nearly $3 million. Well, I can tell you now, a $3 million award barely gets a blip in the local newspaper, whereas before it was, it would have been a major news item. I think the public has become somewhat immune to the idea of big verdicts because we've seen them in major, whether it's pharmaceutical cases, we've seen them in the state litigation against the tobacco industry, we've seen it even in medical liability cases brought against physicians. We've become somewhat used to the idea of tens of millions and even hundreds of millions of dollars in awards being made through our courts.
Mm. Let me just ask a question going back to this, the principle of comparative fault or comparative negligence, and I hope that I'm understanding this correctly because I am not an attorney, but it's my understanding that until, you know, maybe about two decades ago, that plaintiffs, that is, the people who are bringing the claim of damage, were required to show they were not negligent in any way in order to recover. That is, that they, not even in a small part, did some action on their part contribute to their injury. And that is something that in recent years has changed as we get to this principle that we share out some liability, but we say at least the defendant still has to have the majority of the liability. But if the plaintiff shares in some of that, we'll still say that the case can go ahead. That there was a time not all that long ago that wasn't true, and that limited the number of these cases. Are you arguing that we should go back to that point where we said that in order for a case to go forward and for a person to claim damages and recover, that the plaintiff must show that he was in no way at fault?
No, and it's not our policy to argue that there should be a fundamental return to what's called contributory negligence. Now, I will say there are a few jurisdictions. I live actually in Maryland, which is one of the states that still has it. And you've, from an academic standpoint, you've described it correctly. I think, though, in terms of the way it's actually applied, it's done, I don't know if I should probably use this term, a little more humanely. But we are in the, from the standpoint of advocating reform, we are reflecting the fact that the predominant law of the land is comparative negligence, it's comparative fault. And so our focus is on how to ensure, that comparative fault is achieved equitably. Because as you pointed out, under comparative fault, if it's determined, for example, that a plaintiff may have contributed in small part to his or her injury, then that can be reflected in the award. If it's 10% or 15%, then if it's, a $100,000 award, then it would be reduced by that amount. Our focus, and I think that makes good sense as the law has evolved, but our point is that particularly with respect to, and this is generally where the debate focuses, with respect to non-economic damages such as pain and suffering, some of the other ways that individuals are compensated for losses other than, say, their health costs, quantifiable losses such as lost wages or rehabilitation costs, but for things like pain and suffering, loss of enjoyment of life, which are losses, but they are inherently subjective. It's really the debate tends to focus on that area, and I think again, it's applying the law in an equitable way. Contributory negligence, the idea of what's called joint liability, which puts the individual, or if someone is judged to have been at fault, even in part, under the old system of contributory negligence, you can see an argument for allowing a plaintiff to recover from any of the defendants, because there you really do have no fault on the part of the plaintiff. But here you're really keeping score in effect about how liability and is applied, and really who is and who is not at fault, and it's done in terms of proportions, and we think think that should be carried through. Right.
Well, just to – I have a couple of callers here. I want to get to them. But basically, you do endorse the proposal. And again, as I understand it, what the administration is proposing in terms of reform basically is to place a cap on these non-economic damages, these things that are often referred to as damage awards for pain and suffering, to place some limits on how much attorneys can collect because, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, in many of these cases – attorneys are on a contingency basis, which means that if they collect some portion of what they get for you as their client, and if that means that if they lose, they don't get anything, there would be some limits placed on how much the attorney could collect. And then also, there apparently is a proposal that damages not be paid in a lump sum, but that they be paid periodically, say, no more than $50,000. That would be an annual payment over time. Those things you would support, those kinds of changes?
Those are the sort of the central elements of what has been the law in California for 25 years. And it's really the law of California, which has done a great deal. Really, it's been indispensable to stabilizing the litigation system for patients and doctors in California. That's been the basis for federal legislation for a number of years and is what the administration and many in Congress have urged become the law of the land.
And that did result, that change that went into effect in California, I believe, in 1975, that did result in fewer lawsuits Well, certainly it would have resulted in putting a cap on the damages, so no doubt the awards are less. But what about the number of lawsuits?
One of the things that it does is it's helped to speed the process along, at least from the information that we've seen. Litigation, when the law is uncertain, when the prospects for an unlimited award are threatening, it just makes it that much more difficult for the insurer or the person, the entity defending a healthcare provider or organization to make intelligent judgments about how to handle a particular claim. Probably what's most relevant to the whole debate is to go to the American Medical Association's website and look at the states that are in crisis in terms of access to critical healthcare providers. When you look at the most affected specialties, the high-risk specialists, such as neurosurgeons, trauma surgeons. When you look at OBGYNs and the obstetric part of that medical discipline, what you see is that the states that have enacted really good medical liability reform are the ones that are in the best shape as far as with California being among them. You have states like Pennsylvania. Unfortunately, your state of Illinois is experiencing, at least from what we've been told, problems. Mississippi was having very, very serious problems, which we think are beginning to be addressed by some legislative action. It's not going to happen overnight, but if the major issue, if you're making policy or making a judgment about medical liability reform, is to look at the overall access to healthcare issue. And I think the evidence is overwhelming that this is an important component of an effort to ensure access to healthcare for critical specialties.
We have a couple callers, and I want to bring them into the conversation. And for anyone who has just tuned in, I should also introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Sherman Joyce. He is president of the American Tort Reform Association. This is a national organization made up of nonprofits, professional societies, trade associations, and corporations that are interested in making changes in the tort system as it exists here in the United States. Again, as I said at the beginning of the program, obviously there are different points of view on this. There are some people who feel that there is no need to change the system, and we will be doing some shows in the future with some other guests who have different points of view, but this is sort of the first program that I expect we'll try to have a number of these conversations to give the chance to hear different points of view and also to ask questions. And if you would like to ask a question, you can do that by calling us 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a couple couple of callers here. One to start us off in Indiana on our line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Usually I have a definite opinion on these things, and this one I don't particularly, but I feel there are certain aspects of it that usually go towards the right. And so I have 3 questions. One, why don't you go after the insurance companies? Why not put a cap on what they can charge doctors for malpractice? Secondly, how do you expect every state legislature get together to enact these things you want, or is this a federal law that will take precedent over all other states? Legislatures decide what they want to do, and why are you after the lawyers? They don't set the cost level at all. It's the jury. I mean, why not handicap the jury? You know, why go after people who are working? Thank you.
Okay. Well, the caller asked a number of points. Maybe let me ask you just to respond first to the second point, because, again, as I understand it, what we're talking about here, these kind of laws are a matter of state law. But the proposal is now, I think, though, for there to be a set of uniform standards so that all states, so the law would be the same from one place to the next.
Well, they're all good questions, and let me try to give you an answer for that one. I think that particularly conservative members of Congress, and I did used to work there for a number of years, I think would always look with some skepticism at the idea of creating sort of national standards for a matter that is fundamentally a matter of state law. I would add that, so I think that the burden on those of us who are arguing for this type of reform is on us. I think the argument, though, is easily made. When you look at the impact that passing national legislation, say, on medical liability would have on the federal treasury, when you look at the impact that excessive litigation costs have on the federal Medicare program, on the costs of defensive medicine have been studied, and all the scholars agree that doctors too often prescribe tests or recommend tests and procedures more just to protect themselves against the prospect of litigation. All these costs, I think, would help to deal with the cost of health care and the federal government's role in it. So there's clearly a link between this issue, and there's a reason for Congress to tackle this beyond the fact that they may think it's a good idea. The caller also asked about going after insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
Insurance companies, and I'm not an expert on insurance regulation, but what I do know is that insurance companies are regulated. They are regulated to do 2 things. Number one, to make sure, probably most important, that they have enough money in the till to pay claims. If somebody were to come in and simply say, I'm going to charge you XYZ premium, and really substantially underpriced the market, they could create a real problem for their insureds if there's no money there to pay the claims. So they have to ensure, they have to look at premiums to make sure that they are enough to cover the likely exposures. Secondly, they look at them to assess whether they're reasonable. Are they gouging their insureds or the people that they're writing the policies for? They have to get their premiums and their policies approved. So they are being regulated. You can argue about whether that regulation is sufficient. But I think particularly with respect, and this is probably not as well known, with respect to physicians and other health care providers, many of them in the past found the commercial insurance market not to be sufficiently responsive to the concerns and the needs that they had. So a lot of state medical associations and other state-based organizations went out and raised the money and created their own insurance companies, companies that they themselves, in effect, are the owners of. And these are organizations. There's a great group called the Physicians Insurers Association of America. These are doctor-owned medical liability insurers. And they are separate. They're different, though they're competitive with the major commercial insurers. So the idea that somehow that it's just that they're seeking profits, it's basically the doctors themselves that are that have raised the capital to create these insurance companies. So there's a lot's been done there. Arguably, you can look at the insurance regulation process, but we think that's separate and distinct from the whole question of liability. And as far as going after lawyers, I think that there are plenty of laws on the books. Probably the most stringent restriction on attorneys' fees was passed by the Congress under the Federal Tort Claims Act. Lawyers suing the federal government in a tort case where that's permissible can recover relatively little. In Social Security disability cases, I think it's 15%. What's contemplated in California is a gradual scale of I think starting at a maximum of 40%, and then as the award goes higher, a slightly lesser amount. But it's again, that's a judgment call that the California legislature has made.
Other callers here. We'll go next to line number one, and that's someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I'll admit my bias from the start. I am highly skeptical of the whole tort reform movement, so I will phrase my question carefully when I get to it. First off, on this compensation for lawyers issue and the whole idea of caps, we are a free market economy, and I think it's absurd that the Republican administration, which allows for the chairman of GM to get $13 million for getting fired and sets absolutely no limits on profits or any sort of thing. I think it's absurd that they would talk about caps on punitive damage and suffering. This is a free market economy. The jury system is the American system, and it is based on the free market economics. And so that's a point. But my question, and I will phrase it very politely out of respect to David Inge, is I'm very skeptical of this whole tort reform. I think this is just a large corporate interest. I don't buy this whole thing that medical costs are rising because of malpractice. When you have people making huge profits upstream from the medical providers, I find that ridiculous. So what I would like to know is, without mentioning medical liability reform, what do I, as a small-end person, get from this? I mean, we're in a system that already corporations can commit grievous acts, and they get the record sealed so nobody ever knows what they did wrong, and now you're taking our last, or wanting to cap our last freedom. If it takes $20 million to get McDonald's attention and to get them to behave, you know, ethically or any other large multinational corporation, that's what the free market says. The free market doesn't say, oh, well, we're going to set a cap on it, because they'll just ignore it. So I want to know what I, as a small human being at the opposite end here, I'm going to get from this. I think I'm very skeptical. I think I'm getting ripped off. So I'll get off the air and I'll listen to your response. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Well, the caller, I think, expresses the viewpoint of a lot of people who feel that there is no need for reform, and in fact that the system as it exists is designed to indeed protect and provide some avenue for action for a small individual against some big corporation.
Well, I'll just make a couple of points. I think that, first off, he makes a very principled argument about limiting compensation, and that's a judgment call. But it's a judgment call that the California legislature and governor, and the governor who signed it into law was Jerry Brown, hardly a right-winger, they made because the California has a stake in ensuring access to health care. That's a policy call that elected officials made. You can argue that it's a good judgment, or you can argue that it's not. But since the issue of capping attorneys' fees comes up in that context, I would offer that thought. The reality is that the litigation system is largely invisible to the average person unless you really focus on it. But we, as a society, based on the most recent studies, spend over $230 billion a year on it, and a lot of those costs are passed on to us. We just don't recognize it. Whether you're talking about the cost of something like an automobile, the cost of pharmaceutical products, or even the cost that your local dry cleaner has to pass on to you to cover the prospect of future litigation. These are not things that you see, but these are things that affect your lives. But the gentleman mentioned the free market on punitive damages. The free market does not trump the Constitution. The U.S. Supreme Court, and it's not been, and the gentleman, I don't know what his politics are, but the dissenters in these cases have been Justices Scalia and Thomas. But the majority of the court, absent Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, have been ruling consistently that excessive punitive damage awards violate the Constitution of the United States. Ultimately, what it comes down to when it comes to civil litigation is: do you want it to be the equivalent of a rifle shot, drive-by shooting that you want to? One day you may feel like you want to take it out on a company, or do we want to have a balanced and intelligent set of rules, both with respect to the substance, the duties of care that are owed between one party to another, and the appropriate procedures. But when it comes to punitive damages, the court has spoken very clearly in recent years that excessive punitive damages and the failure to rein them in properly violates the U.S. Constitution. That has nothing to do with the free market. And those of us who care about the rule of law should care about that fact.
Let's go to another caller. This is line 2 in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I'm interested in the relationship between the medical care and these civil lawsuits you've been talking about. Two examples or two questions. How is the law in California, the 73 or 75 law, whenever that was, what impact has it had on the quality of medical care offered in California? Second part, I have read in many places that someplace between 60 and 90,000 people needlessly die in our hospitals, and that even a lot of hospitals don't take autopsies anymore because the results can be used against them. So besides using the stick of the civil lawsuit, how do you get hospitals to reform? Thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, again, you respond to that question however you like.
Well, in terms of the quality of the care, I'm not in a position to make a judgment. I think what's critical in terms of making policy and the relationship of the law to the quality of care is making sure that you have the experts and the specialists that you need. California is one of, according to the American Medical Association, one of only a handful of states that's not experiencing very, very serious problems. And I think that if you're looking at the delivery of health care, probably, you know, again, I'm not an expert, but it seems to me that you would start by ensuring that you've got the experts, the specialists that you need, because there are communities that are really hurting in that department. The best example was a few years back when the Nevada lost its only level one trauma center in the whole state. That's a very large area. And it closed. That's the level one trauma centers are the places where the people who have the most serious injuries, whether it's a car accident or some other very, very serious injury to themselves, are taken, usually often in helicopters. But they had to close the only one in the state until the legislature went about and set about to fix some of the underlying liability problems. As far as the numbers of needless deaths, the only, one thing I can tell you is that that organized medicine, I think, is trying to focus on these matters. There are institutional issues, which I certainly am not in a position to comment on, that I think need to be addressed. But I would add that you know, we certainly support and believe that the civil justice system can and should be available to people who have suffered. The problem is that that at least the evidence indicates that there are too many cases that come about that have no merit. We say that because they may not be frivolous, but they result in a zero verdict, according to the insurers for physicians. And I think far too often there have been viable claims and legitimate claims that don't get their day in court. And we ought to try to straighten the system out so that those people with legitimate claims can get their get their day in court. They can move their process along quickly. And they'll get compensation in a swift and balanced way.
Let me ask you just to a further question on that point, because I think that there are some, when we get into this discussion, that often people talk about the problem as being the runaway jury, the juries who are awarding these extraordinarily large dollar amounts in damages for plaintiffs. Some people, I think, would argue that the problem is not with the jury. The jury is just trying to do what they think their job is, but that the problem has to do with the fact that initially a judge has to decide whether a claim for damages can go to trial in the first place. And in the words of one of the articles that I read, apparently there are some judges who have literally said, who am I to judge? Let the jury decide. And that what's happened here is that judges and also legislatures have abdicated their responsibility to establish clear rules about who can sue and for what. And that's really the problem, that we ought to be more carefully conscientious and thoughtful about what cases we allow to go to trial in the first place.
Well, I think that's exactly right, and I think that a jury, if it's allowed or really encouraged to reach a result that I or others might disagree with, the fact is that judges control the courtrooms. Judges make very key determinations about whether particular expert evidence can be admitted. Whether an individual has the credibility and the standing to offer what is often very powerful testimony. The basic rules of evidence provide that regular witnesses can testify as to what they saw, what they heard, what happened, but expert witnesses can testify about what they think and what their views are, and that's very significant. It may not sound important, but it really is. And policing that process, having a balanced system, we're very supportive of the jury system. In fact, we're working with some organizations around the country to promote a better system for encouraging broader participation in serving on juries and ensuring that it's not an undue hardship for too many people.
Well, let's talk with some other listeners. Champaign County, next, line number three. Hello.
Hi. I'm also very skeptical of this whole movement, and comes from a completely different direction than the previous caller, but I do share a skepticism. And one of the things that I see is the marshaling of statistics. The gentleman here is pretty suave and pretty polished. That's a compliment, I guess. But this idea...
I'm not sure my wife would agree with that, but thank you.
Uh-huh. The figure that you gave for as a gross amount for litigiousness in the society, most of that is actually businesses suing other businesses. It really dwarfs the amount of money that's involved in these personal injury cases, et cetera, et cetera. In Illinois, we were treated to some. We kind of missed out on all of the negative advertising, but because the Illinois Supreme Court has ruled that a cap on non-economic, as it's called, damages is unconstitutional. There was a huge stake involved in who was going to be returned to the Supreme Court, and apparently the negative advertising knocked out someone who was sympathetic to that ruling. I am sympathetic to that ruling. What I see is that when you rule everything out except for economic damages, you're basically saying that a millionaire is worth more than a working man. That you can only add up the lost wages, lost, et cetera. And I think that's just generically unfair that you're saying that, there are other eventualities that could happen. A person could be making more money. And I just think it's a wrong way to define things. One other point you made about insurance that was called in earlier was there are arguments made that one of the reasons why malpractice rates went up was not reflecting an increase in malpractice, that actually, there are changes from year to year. But the insurance companies actually were losing money in the stock market and were not able to raise their malpractices because they weren't doing as well in their other sectors. So that... that's an argument I've heard made, and I've never heard it really countered extremely well.
Well let me counter it, because
right.
at least with respect to the insurers that these doctors have set up, and again, I'm getting the data from their trade association, about over 80% of their investments that they make, and they can't invest all the premiums that they get, but 80% of their of what they invest is in very high-quality bonds. Less than 10% is actually invested in stocks.
Well, let me stop you, because I think you're already citing some. These are organizations that have been recently started. They're sort of self-insured by doctors' organizations. These represent a strategy to counter the fact that the regular malpractice people were exacting a pound of flesh.
Well, what I'm suggesting to you is that doctor-owned insurers, if you want to believe that somehow they're going to try to sort of gouge themselves, then I'm not in a position to argue with you. What I'm trying to tell you is the majority, I'm talking nationally, the clear majority of doctors in this country purchase their insurance from these physician-owned companies. And these companies have a very conservative approach to investing. But another matter with respect to insurance, again, I'm really kind of stretching the limits of my knowledge, is that if an insurance company loses money in year one, whether it's through its investment portfolio or it's the losses that they incurred or had to pay out were greater than they anticipated, they're not allowed. Regulators do not allow them to make up for it in the next year. That's simply, now maybe the regulation process doesn't work as you would hope, but that is a black letter principle of insurance regulation. They have to take that loss and they have to live with it. So the idea that somehow they're going to make up for it in the next year, quite frankly, does it happen? May it happen if the regulators allowed it? But at least what the regulators tell us is that that's not the case.
Well, again, we're both arguing out of ignorance here. What about the idea?
I'm not offering opinion. I'm telling you what the Physician Insurers Association tells us. Now, if you don't
gave
think
enough
telling...
caveat, you get sir, you gave enough caveats that you prefaced your remark by saying that you were talking outside of your bonds. So why don't I'm trying to get you to talk about this whole idea that by limiting mainly to economic losses, that you're basically saying one person's life is so much less than worth so much less than another's.
Well, I think the question comes down to what do we want our legal system to do? Do we want it to exist to make the average person on the street, the people I can see walking outside my building, give them the same economic status as Bill Gates? If that's the case, then we're going to have to fundamentally change the way we deal with litigation. What our justice system was designed, and you may not agree with this, but what we were taught, what I was taught a long time ago, is it's to make people whole. It's not to make them rich, and it's not to denigrate them. It's to make them whole. If I were injured in a case, my economic losses would not be as great as would be the chairman of General Motors. Somebody else may not do as well as I would. That's what our system was founded to do. Now, you can argue that we should have other systems or the legal system should be changed, but that's the fundamental that we're going from. And I would also add that individuals, whether it's a man or a woman who may predominantly spend time raising children or working out of a home, those are quantifiable losses. If you have to replace those services, if you have to replace the functions that individual performs, it's not going to rise to the level of a highly compensated executive, but they can be and oftentimes are substantial. And actually, lawyers generally do a pretty good job of assessing what those are likely to be. If you're talking about a child, they can make assessments. If someone has suffered permanent injury, it can be very, very substantial going forward, both in terms of maintaining the child and anticipating lost earnings and the like. So I think it's sure. Is it going to provide everybody the same? No, our system doesn't exist for that purpose. If it did exist, then we really would have to fundamentally reconfigure the way our civil litigation is done.
I need to jump in here because we only have about 5-6 minutes. I have some other callers. I just do want to follow up very quickly on the kind of example that you just cite, because I have seen in many cases, in the articles that I've read on the subject, addressing this very point, that if you cap pain and suffering and that you force attorneys to rely primarily for to take care of their fees and the cost of taking a case forward, the percentage of the economic damages that a person can be awarded. Indeed, if you have somebody who is on the lower end of the pay scale, or perhaps you're talking about someone, as in a particular case that I read about in Texas, a woman who was a stay-at-home mom, a working mom, died. There was a question of medical malpractice, and her husband was trying to bring a case forward. And attorneys looked at it and said, look, I'm sorry. We know how much it would take to try this case. We know how much we think that we can recover for you for economic damages. And there's no way that we can take the case because it won't cover the costs. And the argument is that here we're actually going to have some people whose economic losses are significant. Lawyers will take those cases because they think they can cover their costs. For people whose economic losses are less, some lawyers might say, look, I'm sorry, I would like to take that case, but I can't. And so that we will have some people who can't get representation at all.
Well, I think finding good representation and finding people to take cases is an issue. You know, when you hear the most prominent members of the plaintiff's bar, the very best lawyers, you'll hear them say that, well, they only take one out of 20 or one out of 50 that come in the door. I think that is a problem. I think that speaks to a problem, and it's an argument for figuring out ways, particularly with smaller claims, and we're certainly open to this, whether you're talking about medical liability or just or any other type of personal injury type case. Figure out ways so that justice and the process can move more quickly and can move with lower cost. And lawyers, I think some have given a lot of thought to this, and there are some interesting ideas out there about how to do that. I would simply say this: the points that I was trying to make about insurance. You know, again, I'm not an insurance policy expert. But what I do know is, and contrary to what the previous caller said, is that the investment decisions, that's not an issue as far as those doctor-owned insurers who provide the bulk. That's not my opinion. That's a fact as stated by those companies themselves. And insurance regulators will tell you what I said, which is that they don't allow excessive premiums simply to make up for past losses. But coming back to the medical liability issue, we can talk about future changes and possible changes. We have a very substantial body of experience out in California, and to the best of my knowledge, and now others may disagree, people who have legitimate medical liability claims do find people who can bring them. There is an ability to have those claims processed. But I'd be the first to say that our system there are a lot of different aspects of what we could tackle. We have to focus on those things that we think are most relevant, such as the apportionment of liability, ensuring that punitive damages are awarded consistent with the U.S. Constitution and the like.
I want to try to get at least one more caller in here quickly. Line one, Champagne. Go ahead.
Is that me?
Yes.
David, you touched on this, but my question was about really how would you replace contingency? Contingency is what's used by a lot of lawyers, and in a sense, it levels the playing field. And you know, the potential of a large award is what's used, and so the defendants, the corporations or whatever, their attorneys are being paid. So how would you what would you replace?
Yeah.
What would you replace that with?
I can give you maybe about a minute here, Mr. Joyce. I don't think that you're necessarily arguing to get rid of contingency. Just place some limits on how much money.
Well, no. And again, the earlier caller talked about the free market, and that's a very valid argument. one thing that we would argue is to really give, really empower the average person going in to see a lawyer ought to know what his or her rights are. Lawyers ought to be telling individuals, well, this is a case that, you know, that could be won, or I should be able to get an answer pretty easily. And the term contingent suggests some kind of risk. And after the fact, lawyers should be, whether it's on a contingency fee basis or otherwise, should be telling their clients after the fact how much work they actually did. Because I demand that of the lawyers that work for us, and I want to know that, and think that everybody should have that. Simply put, let's give them the sort of power and the knowledge that they would need, and also advise them that, you know, that they have other options, which, if the case is likely to be successful, they may want to pursue, and leave that in the hands of the consumer.
Well, we're going to have to stop there for this time around. We will, however, in the future, be doing some other shows on this subject. We'll have some other guests who have different points of view, so you'll have the same opportunity to hear from them and ask questions. But for the moment, we want to say thanks to our guest, Sherman Joyce, president of the American Tort Reform Association. Mr. Joyce, thanks very much for being with us. And if people are interested in the association, their positions on this issue, and they have internet access, they can go to their website, which is www.atra. That's for American Tort Reform Association, atra.org. Programming here on AM 580 made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at americanclassifieds.com. Programs also made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Coming up in the next part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Iran and the relationship between Iran and the United States. Certainly, there has been a good deal of tension lately around the issue of whether or not Iran is pursuing a program to develop nuclear weapons. And then certainly there has been a lot of tension between Iran and the United States going back some time, certainly to the fall of the Shah, the Iranian Revolution, and some would say even further back than that. Our guest in the next hour will be Ken Pollack. He is director of research at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., author of a new book titled The Persian Puzzle, The Conflict Between Iran and America. And we'll be talking with him coming up in just a little bit. We'll have news at 1 minute past the hour, but first, an update on the market, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
And with this update on the markets coming up on 1059, I'm Jay Pierce. Good morning. December wheat on the Chicago Board of Trade at 290.5 is up 3.5. March at